right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and really happy to be here today. That's right, extremely happy, all right? Because we got a great show for you. At the back end of the show, we're going to be joined by Wayne Kramer. That's right, Wayne Kramer of MC5 fame, and actually more, just a tremendous person, a guitarist, an activist, co-founder of Jail Guitar Doors, and we're going to be talking about Jail Guitar Doors and all of that, all right? So stay tuned for that. In the middle of the show, we'll be talking with William Robinson, professor of sociology, global and Latin American studies at UC Santa Barbara. And we'll be talking about the targeting of U.S. university professors by various Zionist groups. All right, that's going to be a hell of a discussion, so stay tuned for that. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to be welcoming back a frequent guest and an always appreciated guest, Sansara Taylor. Sansara is actually down in Texas right now, and she's a writer for Revolution Newspaper and StopPatriarchy.org, and she's been down in Texas for quite some time as part of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. She and four others from the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride on August 27th were arrested. They were arrested for blocking a street by the University of Texas Austin during the Week of Defiance, and Texas is on the front line of a savage war on women. And Sansara has said that the situation in Texas is a concentration of the national emergency facing women's rights to abortion. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, good to hear you. Quite a bit has happened, and I want to jump into this. As people know who've been listening over the last month or so, we've talked to you regularly about the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride down in Texas and the whole situation that's been going on around the threatened closure of all but six abortion clinics in Texas. And on Friday, there was a temporary injunction was issued by a judge that was against the enforcement of the law that would close all but six abortion clinics. Let's talk about that. What do you think about that? What's your take on that?
Well, I think it's in immediate terms, it's extremely important that on Friday, Judge Lee Yackel, a federal district judge here in Austin, Texas, he didn't just issue an injunction. He actually ruled that the elements of HB 2 that were scheduled to go into effect, a new law scheduled to go into effect on September 1st, were unconstitutional. And he actually said they're totally unconstitutional. They're not founded in law, and they should not stand. And this is very important because in immediate terms, this has prevented the closure of, there's 19 abortion clinics in the state. It would have been down to six today, and that has not happened. Those clinics can stay open. A second portion of his ruling was to decide that the previous restrictions, about 2 years ago, there was 44 abortion clinics in the state. Now there are only 19. And those were mainly closed based on another dimension of HB 2, which was an anti-abortion law passed about a year and a half ago that required clinics that do abortions to have doctors with arrangements with local hospitals to admit patients. It's medically unnecessary. It's totally a law designed to close abortion clinics. And it did, and it closed down over half the abortion clinics in the state. The second portion of Judge Lee Yackel's ruling was that not to throw that out as a whole, but to say that in the regions of the Rio Grande Valley and El Paso, Texas, because those are two extremely impoverished regions, because they are very, very geographically remote from anywhere, you know, where there are other urban areas and abortion clinics, that to allow those clinics to have been closed based on that hospital admitting privileges law, which they were, they have been closed, that should be lifted in those places because it places an undue burden on women to access their abortion rights, which is the Supreme Court standard at this point. And so what this means is, one, no further clinics will close in the immediate term, and two, there is the basis for the clinics down in the Rio Grande Valley and in El Paso to reopen. So this is a very, very important victory. At the same time, it's a partial victory. Half the clinics have been closed. And it's not the final word because this has already been appealed to the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans. This is being challenged, and it's against the backdrop of just rolling abortion clinic closures across the country over decades and actually escalating in the last 3 years. So we are celebrating this victory, but we are not relaxing. It is not a time to cool it out. It's actually a time to redouble our efforts and remain vigilant and actually even more active because the higher up you go in the courts, the more hostile they are to women's rights.
Now, Sansara, I wanted to ask you this. Can you explain to people, just so they're clear, for people who haven't been following it as closely as maybe others have, when this judge ruled that this law that was scheduled to go into effect on September 1st was unconstitutional, can you just, you know, sort of briefly explain to people what exactly was the law that was ruled unconstitutional?
Yeah, so HB 2 was a law passed about a year and a half ago. It was, people may remember, hopefully remember, there was massive protest in Texas against this law. Wendy Davis did a many-hour filibuster. Thousands of people poured into the Capitol to protest this, and they actually prevented the law from being passed for a few days. And then Governor Rick Perry called a special session, and he forced the law through. And so this law had four dimensions. One was restrictions on medication abortions, the abortion pill, which makes it much harder to obtain and requires women to go into the clinic four different times to get that pill administered. It's totally medically unnecessary, but it puts this out of reach of many women, especially women who have to travel hundreds of miles to an abortion clinic. That is in effect. That's already the law of the land in Texas. They also passed a hospital admitting privileges law, which requires every doctor who does abortions to have an agreement with a local hospital to admit patients. Most hospitals are denying this because they don't want to get involved in abortion and the protests involved, but also because abortion is so safe that the doctors don't even meet the requirements of how many patients you have to admit each year to have those kinds of arrangements. It's too safe. So this shut down over half the abortion clinics in the state. That's in effect. The third dimension of it is that abortion is banned after 20 weeks of pregnancy. That's an effect. Women can't get abortions after 20 weeks in Texas. And the fourth dimension was the ambulatory surgery center requirements, which essentially said that you can only do an abortion in a facility that it has the same physical layout as basically a mini emergency room. And it's monetarily, it's cost-wise prohibitive. It's just extremely expensive. Most clinics don't meet those requirements. There's no necessity for it. Abortion is an outpatient procedure. About a 5 or 6 minute procedure. It's very simple. It's safer than childbirth. You can have a child in your living room. That's legal. It should not require this. So two dimensions of this law are in effect and have closed down clinics or made abortion more difficult to access. Actually, three of the dimensions are in effect. The one dimension that was being challenged with this recent court case that was ruled unconstitutional was the ambulatory surgery center requirements. I'm sorry, but it's a lot of legalese and a lot of confusion. This is actually part of their strategy, is to bog people down in all these technical dimensions. The totality of each of these, all of them, were designed solely to close down abortion access. But they're all in the name of women's safety. And this is why they're so insidious. And this is part of why they also need to be exposed and opposed.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor. She's talking to us from deep in the heart of Texas. And Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and one of the initiators of StopPatriarchy.org. You know, one of the things that I know, there was a statement that was issued by StopPatriarchy.org. And one of the things that I was thinking about there, where you had Merle Hoffman talk about, from the advisory board, talk about that this is one battle and an ongoing war, and we must remain vigilant. And you spoke and said that the anti-abortion movement will not stop. You basically said that, you know, we really have to pay a lot of attention and not sort of then sit back and say, okay, this is taken care of now. Now, you've spoken to that in terms of the possibility of this ruling being overturned, but I thought you were speaking a little bit broader with that, too, that this that the anti-abortion movement itself is not, you know, they're not going to stop until they've criminalized all abortions for women in all circumstances. And this is sort of the emergency situation that women are facing, and it's still very much in effect.
Yeah, this is one of the main goals of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride and of StopPatriarchy.org in this fight, is to actually expose to people, make clear to millions in this country, that the fight over abortion has never been a fight about babies. It's never been a fight about making it safer for women. It's never been a fight over reducing the number of unwanted pregnancies and all of this. It's been a fight at its core by the anti-abortion movement, the so-called pro-life movement, to force women back to the days of bearing children against their will, of being enslaved to their reproduction. It's a view driven by fundamentalist Christianity that actually thinks that women have gotten all out of their place. Women have gotten all out of control, and they need to be forced back to the position of being subordinate to men and breeders of children. And at its core, you know this is true because the anti-abortion movement is also anti-birth control. It is also anti-sex education. It's not about reducing abortions, even. It's you know, which if that's what you were trying to do, you would promote birth control. It's about really forcing women back to the position of sex should only be engaged in because you want to procreate. Women should not have sex. Women should not have control over their lives, their destinies, their bodies. So their strategy, they've realized that this is not something that the public really, most people don't agree with that. I mean, correctly so, most people don't agree with that. So they don't come out and say that. Instead, they have more of a salami technique, just peeling away one slice after the other of, you know, saying, well, we just want to make abortion safer. We just want to make it safer. They create a myth that abortion is unsafe, which it is not. It's 10 times safer than childbirth, 14 times safer in the first trimester. But they make a myth that it's unsafe. They fabricate all these lies. And then they say, oh, but let's have it in a hospital-type setting. Let's make sure that doctors who do abortions have hospital admitting privileges. Let's just more thoroughly regulate medication abortions, the abortion pills. And these are some of the laws that we're facing in Texas, but also are being introduced around the country. And they sound innocuous. They sound like they're concerned with women's lives, that they're concerned with women's health care. And they're very confusing because you have to walk through what's the why are hospital admitting privileges not really going to make it safer, and why are they not necessary, and all of this, which we have answers to. But it convolutes the argument when at the core they're doing this because they know it's a way to step-by-step shut down clinics and at the same time kind of slide under most people's radar. So with StopPatriarchy.org and with the Freedom Ride, the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride, and I think it's very sobering to recognize this. If it wasn't for the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride in the last month and a half being in Texas, there would have been no visible public opposition to this law going into effect. There was massive protest when the law was being introduced. But once it was passed, there's been no mobilizations of active resistance. And it's very important that this happened, both because I think this played into the decision, but even on a more fundamental level, because we are fighting a war over the future of women. Are women going to be forced back to being breeders of children, enslaved to their reproduction, or will women be treated as full human beings, which requires abortion on demand and without apology? And this is why we felt so strongly to come down to Texas and wage this fight in what really is ground zero in this war on women across the country, but also to wage it in a way that builds up people's understanding, their organization, and mass independent political resistance to fight against this, because it is just one battle in an ongoing war, and it's going to get more intense.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Sansara Taylor. She's talking to us from deep in the heart of Texas, and Sansara is a writer for Revolution Newspaper and one of the initiators of StopPatriarchy.org. Now, Sansara, you've just been talking about the importance of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride in building the opposition and the vocal opposition and the present opposition to this assault on women, and especially in Texas at this time as the front line on that. Can you talk a little bit about you just recently had the Week of Defiance. Can you talk about what happened there, and including the fact that you and a number of others were arrested in the course of that?
Yes, so in the final week before this law was scheduled to go into effect, and everything looked like this was going to go into effect, and that come September 1st, there would only be 6 abortion clinics left in the second largest population-wise state in the country. And so we called for people across the country and here in Texas to take to the streets, to raise their voices, to go and wage public protests and public acts of resistance. And this took a number of forms. Every single day we had rallies outside of Governor Rick Perry's mansion in Austin at the Capitol in Texas. And we had people send their messages through Twitter, through email, through different ways. And we wrote each of them on a coat hanger. Coat hangers were wire coat hangers. Women used them to self-induce abortions. They inserted them into their vaginas and tried to induce bleeding. Oftentimes they punctured their uteruses and bled to death or got infections and died. So we brought coat hangers symbolizing that with these messages to Rick Perry, and we brought them to his mansion every day. We had acts of a lot of defiant protests there, but we also had around the country people went into public with the faces of women who lost their lives due to illegal abortion. And we're bringing this alive to the public. This is what they're trying to force us back to. This is not some wedge issue, as it's often called. This is not some side issue. This is a central question for all women. And then one of the high points in the week was on Wednesday, the 23rd. It was the first day of classes at the University of Texas Austin campus. And we held a protest at the main entrance to that campus on a very, very busy street and busy walkway where thousands, literally thousands of students walked by and saw this protest, and hundreds gathered. And at a certain point, people went into the street and they protested in the middle of the intersection, and traffic was backed up, and people stayed there and rallied for over half an hour with people joining from the sidelines, hundreds of students stopping and gathering. And we put the challenge to people very boldly, and we were wearing all white with gushing blood stains in our crotches and down our legs, symbolizing the women who would hemorrhage and die from illegal abortions. And we were in the streets, and we had the pictures of these women, And we were putting the challenge. Every day you go to class, you're being told to think about what you want to be when you grow up. You're being trained for your career in this world to maybe do some good on the side of the margins, but mainly to seek a career. And we're putting a different question, not who do you want to be when you grow up, but what kind of world do you want to live in? And the future of women is being shaped right now. This is a watershed moment and decision. 1 in 3 women will get an abortion. This is you and your peers. What are you going to put on the line to stop this at this moment when we really could shape the unfolding of history on this? And it was a very, very powerful protest, and it had a huge impact on the students. Many of them, you know, did stay and watch the whole thing. Some of them joined us in the streets. We've been hearing from some of them since. And, yes, 5 of us were arrested. We went through the whole Texas jail experience, which was a small taste of it, but I'll tell you, in the most highest rate of incarceration in the world is in the U.S. The highest rate of incarceration in the country is in Texas, and the fastest growing section of the prison population is women. And so we were in the entry point of women into the prison in Texas, and it was a very, very heavy experience on that level as well. You just get an intersection of the crimes of this country, the crimes of this system against women and against people overall. But our spirits were very high. The people that we met inside the jail were extremely supportive, not the guards, but the women. And, yeah, we did about 12 hours, and we were released, and we were defiant and continued to carry forward. But we felt that it was really important for people to put their bodies on the line, to act in a way that is commensurate with the stakes for the future of women, and that it's long past time to simply gripe at the television or complain or limit yourself to voting for a lesser evil candidate. Nobody is stopping this war on women. It's on us. And so we wanted to act in that way and to model that for others.
Now, Sansar, in the couple of minutes we have left, what now?
Well, we do want people to get involved in this fight. It is extremely important that these cases will go to the Supreme Court. There are more restrictions being passed all the time. This is a war on women. It is a war with complete disregard for women's lives. And so we're calling on people to go to stoppatriarchy.org to get involved in, you know, both following this case as it goes forward, but spreading the lessons of this experience, taking this onto the campuses. It's extremely important for young people to get involved in this fight and to recognize, look, there was big struggles within the pro-choice movement over this. We were attacked for what we did. We were attacked viciously and in a lot of ugly and unprincipled ways. And it's really important for people to recognize the reason we were attacked is we're breaking with 40 years of a losing strategy. We're breaking out of that, and we're saying we have to confront this head on and fight this. And young people especially, we have a fact sheet. We should take it out to the campuses everywhere. People could start chapters where they are. They can take the faces of the women who died from illegal abortions and go and bring them out on campus or out into the public square, wherever you are, and show this and talk to people about this and gather others who feel similarly. People will come and they'll tell you their stories if you go out with this. We met people everywhere who were thrilled and became part of this movement. And so people listening should become part of this movement with us. You should go to revcom.us and read about the revolutionary analysis and coverage of this, and at stoppatriarchy.org and get connected with the movement that's fighting this now and going forward.
All right, Sansar, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay, take care. And keep in touch so we can follow what's going on, all right?
Will do.
Okay, take care. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Sansar Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper and stoppatriarchy.org, and she is down in Texas as part of the Abortion Rights Freedom Ride. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we will be joined by Professor William Robinson from the University of California, Santa Barbara, talking about, those who dare to criticize Israel in the university and what they face as a result of that and the fight against that. So stay tuned. Don't miss this one.
Thank you.
All right, welcome back. I just had to let that one play out. You know what? Because it just got me energized for the entire rest of the week. All right, and that was The Messenger Speaks from the album Babylon by Savage Rose. A really incredible piece. Someday I'll just play the whole damn song and get everybody up. I thought it was fitting for what we're about to talk about, and I'm not even sure why, just that I really wanted to have this set the mood for our next conversation. Earlier this month, Stephen Salaita, a professor of English literature and American Indian studies, was fired from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign for statements he made on social media against the latest round of Israeli genocidal attacks on Gaza. Sometimes, you know, people don't follow that, or it doesn't get out real broadly what's happening, or people don't understand what's behind it. Well, in 2009, William Robinson, a professor of sociology and global studies at UC Santa Barbara, was the target of a very similar campaign of intimidation and political repression. And that was a campaign that aimed to have him fired from the university. Professor Robinson refused to go down quietly. He exposed what was going on in the world and mobilized students, colleagues, and others to fight alongside him, eventually forcing the university to back down. In the course of this, quite a bit was revealed about the forces behind this assault on academic freedom, the assault on people who dare to stand up and tell the truth. That's one of the reasons why I felt that thing about The Messenger and speaking for those who cannot speak was actually an important song to play in relation to this. Professor Robinson is joining us now to talk about his case, what he learned, and what's the agenda behind it. William, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Sure. Well, first, tell people what actually did happen to you and why you were attacked back in 2009.
Well, 2009 was Operation Kassler. That was the last major Israeli massacre in Gaza. It began in 2008, ended in 2009, right at the beginning of our winter quarter. And I was teaching a course. I had just begun. This was the second class of a course. There were 80 students in the class on global affairs. And so I sent to the course listserv reading material. At the beginning of each class, I start with some discussion of some particular contemporary affair going on in the world to get class discussion going. And so I sent a couple of articles on this Israeli massacre taking place to the listserv for students to read before class. And two of the students, who I had never met before and never have met, didn't like the material. The material condemned Israel, what Israel was doing. And instead of coming to class that evening, again, this was the second class meeting of the quarter, they went to the Israel lobby. They went to Hillel, which is a Jewish organization on campus, which in turn took them to the Anti-Defamation League, Simon Wiesenthal Center, Campus Watch, Stand With Us. These are different organizations which all combined together to form probably the most powerful lobby in the United States, which is set up to persecute, silence, and intimidate any criticism of Israel on campus. That's one of its targets, the academic community, but also in the media and in the political system. They went after me. They declared that I was a litmus test, that if they ran me from the University of California, they would move on aggressively to other campuses and target other faculty and students who would dare to criticize Israel or support the Palestinians. This, of course, was back in 2009, and as you said in your introduction, I had not previously told the whole story. And I decided to do so at this time in the Big Truth Out article because of this latest Israeli massacre, really of genocidal dimensions, and because Professor Stephen Salaita has now come under attack, even worse than I experienced.
Well, you've talked about actually thinking that there perhaps were dozens and if maybe even hundreds of basically professors and other people associated with the universities who get targeted like this. You do think that, huh?
It's not that I think it. That's documented. There are dozens and dozens of documented cases of professors that have not gotten tenure, that have not gotten hired, that have been run from their university, that have been harassed and persecuted and vilified. All of that is documented. This has been going on for years and years, and not just students. Also, I'm sorry, not just professors. Student organizations as well. Just last year, Students for Justice in Palestine and Northeastern University was banned for a year because they tried to bring in a speaker that was defending the Palestinians. And a year after my case, 11 students at the University of California in Irvine, exercising their free speech rights, protested a speech given by the Israeli ambassador to the United States. It was totally peaceful. I mean, didn't violate any law. They were arrested and they were charged and they were convicted of criminal misdemeanors. So it's not something I think. I mean, this is very broadly documented. All of the information is out there. You know, I'm just one case among hundreds.
Yeah, and it's extremely important to recognize that. You know, one of the things, William, that you talked about as you're laying out this whole thing with the Israel lobby, and, you know, for a lot of people, though, they might say, okay, well, that's a catchphrase. He's just, you know, that's, and it's the whole way that there's a lot of defensive thinking that goes on in relation to being very careful about what you say when you're faced with this state that is actually, you know, a lapdog for what the U.S. wants to do around the world. And as you've documented as well, its role that it's played in South Africa with the apartheid regime in Latin America and what it's done to the people of Palestine. It's just an incredible thing that people feel like they have to walk on eggshells in this. And I thought one of the things that was very important in what you've written about and what you've talked about is that this wasn't just the mobilization of the Israel lobby, which we will get into a little bit later, but it also involved what you called a shameful collaboration between university officials and this Israel lobby. Let's talk about how that played out.
Absolutely. The Israel lobby used what I call an inside-outside strategy, meaning that there are administrators and faculty members on campus who are pro-Zionist, pro-Israel, and not just that, that's their right to have those political views, but that are going to impose those views through political persecution, through silencing and intimidation as part of the Israel lobby. So these two students, and by the way, just so say listeners know, Campus Watch is one of the many organizations that form this Israel lobby, which is dedicated to working on campuses. Together, this stands with us, those two organizations. Campus Watch has stated in its own literature, and this is why I said this is not something I think all of this is documented, that it encourages students not to engage in debate with professors, but rather to challenge them through going to the Israel lobby and pursuing political persecution of professors. And so these two students, they never came back to my class. Instead, as I mentioned, they went to the Anti-Defamation League. The Anti-Defamation League directed them to lodge grievances with me with what we call the Charges Office. The Charges Office is a three-person office, administrative office, set up on our campus, supposedly to receive grievances by students who might be victims, for instance, of racial discrimination, of sexual assault, something of that nature, and that's in a very important office. And it's supposed to dismiss charges which we, what we call frivolous, frivolous meaning there's no basis. What the charges are do not violate the faculty code of conduct. So if a professor introduces material, academic material, or which students don't like, they have no basis to complain. They can't. That's academic freedom. They can debate that material in their class. They need to be open to learning new things and so forth. So the Anti-Defamation League said, go and lodge these complaints with the Charges Office. And what I did not know at the time, and this is what I discovered later and only just published now, two members of that Charges Office were prominent members of the Zionist community here in Santa Barbara, and one of them had already met outside the campus with a rabbi here in Santa Barbara who was at the time the president of the B'nai B'rith, which is the parent organization of the Anti-Defamation League, and had discussed how they were going to set up a strategy to prosecute me, to make a test case out of me, to go after me. And so right from the beginning, this was a conspiracy against me. And these two members of the Charges Office itself, made an absolute politicized mockery, a politicized farce. The charges against me were absolutely ridiculous. And all of this is documented in the Truth Out article. It's all also documented with original documents, letters that went back and forth, university, you know, official university letters and so forth, in the Committee to Defend Academic Freedom. If anyone just Googles Santa Barbara Committee to Defend Academic Freedom, it'll come right up. That was a committee set up by students on campus, graduate and undergraduate students, to come to my defense and eventually mobilized a worldwide campaign in my defense, which forced the lobby to back down. But that's one. There were these individuals and others on campus working with the Israel lobby off of campus. The other thing that happened is that top-level administrators from Chancellor Henry Yang right on down stood by silently while all of this was going on. These are outrageous. Absolutely outrageous violations of the university rules for this outside interference, for this conflict of interest, for this type of persecution, violation of academic freedom. The administration simply let it all happen, stood by silent, and made a mockery of academic freedom, did not defend my academic freedom, did not defend the integrity of the university, and let this go on for 6 months while I was nearly run from the university. And I want to mention one other incident because this will really reveal everything. Abraham Foxman came to my campus. Now, Abraham Foxman is probably the most powerful representative of the Israel lobby worldwide, not just in the United States. He's a very powerful figure. He has met with every U.S. president since Richard Nixon and brags about that. He brags that he has open access anytime he wants to the office of the Israeli prime minister, and that his work through the president of the Anti-Defamation League is in collaboration with Mossad. Mossad is the equivalent in Israel of the Central Intelligence Agency. It's their external intelligence agency. Abraham Foxman in mid-March of 2009, this would be about 5 weeks into the persecution against me, came to Santa Barbara for the express purpose of convening a meeting on the campus with the chancellor, with a bunch of deans and a bunch of faculty members, and convened that meeting and called in that meeting for me to be prosecuted. And that was the sole purpose of the meeting. And the meeting went ahead. It was, I would say, close to a secret meeting because it was not publicized. It wasn't open to the public. I knew nothing about it. I was only informed by someone inside the meeting who was outraged by it taking place later on. And so this gives you an idea of the extent to which the Israel lobby descended on the university campus to go after me, and the extent to which the administration either collaborated or stood by silently and allowed this to happen.
You know, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with William Robinson, professor of sociology, global and Latin American studies at UC Santa Barbara. And we're talking about the targeting of U.S. university professors by Zionist groups. And William was actually the target of a very severe campaign back in 2009 around just that question of daring to criticize or tell the truth about what's going on in the world and stepping on some toes that came back with a hammer. And William, one of the things I wanted to ask you is, you know, it was very heavy as I was reading through on your case. And I remember, following it when it was going on. But it was very interesting when you made this point that it was not only very contrived, but it was also very ham-fisted, which in a sense made it all that more dangerous in terms of what was going on, is that anybody who looked at it and examined what they were presenting as so-called evidence just would look at it and say, what the hell's going on here? But it was like barreling ahead. It was like a train that was just jammed out for going full speed down the track. I had to step back a minute when I realized that one of the things I was reading that you had revealed was that at a certain point you were called in for a meeting, and it was like meeting with the Godfather, where somebody said, we're willing to make a deal. If you're prepared to apologize and say you were wrong and beg forgiveness, we'll back off. You know, and you kind of wonder, you know, this is the kind of what that says about what they're trying to do, the legitimacy of what they're trying to do, what they're trying to do in terms of the university campuses. Can we talk about that a little?
Yes, and as you said, the charges against me were absolutely farcical. If you read the charges, and all of that is documented both on the website I mentioned previously, the Santa Barbara Committee to Defend Academic Freedom, but also on this Truthout article I just published, I've cited the charges, and they're, if it weren't so serious, you would say this is some comedy film. I mean, they're absolutely farcical. They're ridiculous. But what happened is about 2 weeks right before they went after me full force, a mediator, they sent a mediator to say, look, someone off campus wants to meet with you and talk about how they'll pull back and they will not attack you. And this person was the rabbi I mentioned, which had already met secretly with this person inside the university pulling the levers of this charges committee. And we met at the mediator's house, and he said to me, well, you know, we will pull back if you repent, if you publicly apologize for what you have done. And I said, well, I didn't do anything morally offensive, and much less did I do anything that transgresses academic freedom and my responsibilities as a professor on the campus. And he said, well, there are people on the campus. And now he's not on the campus. He's a rabbi from the Anti-Defamation League. He said, well, there are people on the campus who disagree with you and are going to go after you if you don't repent. And, I mean, that's when the meeting came to an end, and that's where the full force of this lobby was unleashed.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things related to that that you brought out also is that this whole assault was very much tied to the Israeli government and their PR campaign for world public opinion, with a particular emphasis on college campuses. And there's been a description of seeing the campuses as a modern-day battlefront for Israel. And this is all very organized. And I wanted to talk about that as well as something that came up that I hadn't been aware of, the Hasbara book.
The Hasbara book, exactly. This is very important. The first thing I want to say, you know, is that Israel continues to win the military battles, because we need to remember that Israel is the fifth most powerful military machine in the world. It's also a nuclear power with 300 nuclear warheads. But it is losing the battle for legitimacy. The world is seeing Israel as a colonial project, as an occupational power, as an apartheid system. And it's losing that battle. And as it's losing that battle, it gets desperate, particularly when the BDS, standing for Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions campaign, coming from the call that came out of Palestinian civil society, is gaining a lot of traction. And in the U.S., is gaining traction most of all on college campuses among students and faculty. And therefore, the lobby has declared that it needs to target particularly the big college campuses. And just a month before I was targeted, this would be late 2008, AIPAC, and AIPAC stands for American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee. It's pretty much the nucleus of the Israel support base and lobby in the United States. identified this loss of Israeli legitimacy in international public opinion and said we need to go after the big state universities, and we need to start with the University of California. And then in 2009, I was the very first target that they set up in 2009 to go after. So that's what's going on. And I would say that there are three sectors of world public opinion that are come under attack. One is the academic community. The other is the media. And the third is the political system. And as you said previously in the interview, this results in these persecution campaigns, but it also results in this chilling self-censorship in which academics, in which journalists, in which representatives of the different political tendencies and public life are terrified to even mention the word Palestinian rights or to criticize Israel. But going back also to the Hasbara book that you mentioned, this is the pamphlet published by the, and this is what's so revealing, that's why I said at the beginning of the interview, you know, this is not my opinion, all of this is documented. The Hasbara book is a guidebook distributed to Stand With Us members. Now, Stand With Us is a coalition of about 30 pro-Israeli, pro-Zionist organizations in the United States, including AIPAC, including the Anti-Defamation League, including Campus Watch, and they self-declare that they are the representatives of Israel on U.S. campuses. And this Hasbara book guides Stand With Us members on what to do on campuses. And it declares that you should not enter into reasoned, rational debate with professors or with groups on campus about what's going on in Israel and Palestine. Rather, you should simply silence them by using these different techniques, such as just repeating over and over something, no matter how outrageous it is, and eventually it will be believed. That you should simply intimidate your opponents, that you should slander their name rather than engaging with the actual content of what they're saying, that you should use glittering generalities to describe Israel as freedom and democracy and anti-terrorism. This is the actual words coming out of the Hasbara book. It is quoted, of course, on the Truthout article. And so what I said in the Truthout article is that if you look at these tactics being argued, these are exactly the tactics which Nazi propaganda minister Joseph Goebbels argued for, the big lie. Goebbels said, it doesn't matter if something is a total lie. You just repeat it over and over. It'll eventually be believed. The Hasbara book uses almost the identical language. It says it doesn't matter the content of what we're saying. We just repeat it over and over. The audience will eventually believe it. This is what academics, journalists, public figures are up against, and this is the tactics that are being used.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with William Robinson, professor of sociology, global and Latin American studies at UC Santa Barbara, and we're talking about the targeting of U.S. university professors by Zionist groups. And William was actually the target of a very severe campaign back in 2009. Now, William, we have one more question I wanted to ask you, and it's a big one, because I think what you've been pointing to, it's very important. We've been talking about the chilling atmosphere in the universities and generally in society, this whole question of how this gets approached. I mean, I was thinking even at UCLA where there was some conflict broke out around, I think one of the people running for student government actually had asked that all the people who are running for student government say that they will not accept paid visits to Israel by certain groups that were advocating discrimination against Palestinians and Muslims. And that became such a huge thing that Napolitano, the head of the entire university system and a former head of Homeland Security, felt obliged to weigh in. So I was thinking about this in your case, too. The fact that you've mentioned a lot that one of the things that really broke through for you in being able to beat back this thing was not so much personal courage, which you did have, and dedication to this, but also what was happening on the campuses among your colleagues and society at large. Do you take heart from those things in particular, and especially with this BDS movement?
Oh, unbelievably. Within a week or so of receiving a letter from the Anti-Defamation League, I hadn't mentioned that previously in the interview. There's just so much detail, I can't go into it. The whole thing started when I received a letter from the Anti-Defamation League saying two students are upset with what you did. You'd better do something about this or we're going to go after you. My students, not just my students, graduate and undergraduate students, learned of this and started mobilizing. And they eventually mobilized a worldwide campaign in my defense. I mean, I would not be here if it weren't for the students. Eventually, the students had an international petition drive. They occupied the chancellor's office, a sit-in in the chancellor's office. The chancellor promised to examine the case and talk with them. So they would do the occupation. They were about to reoccupy the office and have a permanent sit-in until I was absolved, and that didn't actually take place because I was eventually resolved. 100 members of the faculty, and we have approximately 400 faculty members, had signed a petition demanding the charges against me be dropped and there be investigation into all of the irregularities and conflict of interest and violation of university rules in going after me. And more would have signed. The petition was still going around. 20 chairs of departments signed a chairs of departments letter saying this is absolutely absurd and this is a egregious violation what the university is doing. The media was following this case, so there was this mass mobilization, and that's another reason why I decided this was a very important time to tell my whole story so that others that are being victimized, such as Stephen Saleta, and others that are self-censoring or are terrified to simply face up to this propaganda machine, this lobby machine, will take heart that Israel is not just losing the battle for legitimacy, but that it's not omnipotent, it's not all-powerful, and we should and need to, both morally and politically, stand up to this machine, and it can be defeated.
Absolutely. William Robinson, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Sure. And is there a place that people can follow what you're doing and what you're writing about this or anything?
Yes. My website is www.soc, for sociology, soc.ucsb.edu/faculty/Robinson. And then there's also, for this particular story, I don't have the address, but if you just Google Truth Out, William I. Robinson, Israel Ordeal, Israel Lobby, I had the big expose of what happened in the Truth Out article about 2.5 weeks ago now.
Mm-hmm. And we'll have all of this up on my Facebook page as well. So, William, thank you very much for joining us today.
Okay, thanks so much.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with William Robinson, Professor of Sociology, Global and Latin American Studies at UC Santa Barbara. And we've been talking about the targeting of U.S. university professors by Zionist groups. And William was a target of a major assault by Zionist groups, and it was turned around and shoved back in their face. All right, so we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Wayne Kramer, guitarist, activist, and co-founder of Jail Guitar Doors, and also just a damn nice guy, okay? So stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Jail Guitar Doors from The Clash. And that song has a lot to do with my next guest, Wayne Kramer, who's actually featured in that song, in the opening lines of that song. That's all about Wayne Kramer. And just for those of you who are hearing this outside of Los Angeles and who are wondering about, well, why am I playing something that's happening in L.A.? Well, I really wanted you to get the chance to hear all about Jail Guitar Doors from Wayne Kramer and hear about Wayne Kramer and what makes him tick and why it's so important that people know about Jail Guitar Doors and what Wayne is doing, all right? So while you may not be able to go to the concert that's being done for Jail Guitar Doors, you will hear all about the movement itself, and you can actually get in touch with Wayne and talk about how you can get involved in Jail Guitar Doors or how you can bring Wayne out to wherever it is you live. So let's jump right into the interview now. Wayne Kramer, formerly of MC5, where
I'm still from the MC5.
Okay.
I'm a lifer in the MC5.
Well, that's a damn good thing to be, okay? Because I listen to at least one album once a week, okay, and maybe more.
Wow.
And it turn it way up, and because it just you need that kind of boost. Anyway, Wayne Kramer from the MC5. Also, recently we had him on the show talking about his album that was called Lexington, which was like an amazing piece. And congratulations, I heard it went. Yeah, right up.
It was a top 10 jazz album.
I was shocked.
I was really shocked. Yeah,
it was. It's a
very
such
exciting,
a powerful, beautiful album, man. It's so nice, but driven. And we talked about the story that it tells and how deep you get into that. And I was listening to it again last night, and I thought, oh God, I need to have an hour to talk with Wayne. Sometime we'll do that, man.
We will. Yeah. I'd be happy to.
It'd be really, really good. Well, let's talk about this because you're having a benefit
Yes,
next
sir.
Next Friday night.
It's our second annual Jail Guitar Doors Rock Out. And we're featuring this year our comrades Tom Morello, Jackson Brown, Ben Harper, and his mom.
I saw that. What a trip. That's very cool.
Is that not, isn't that the coolest?
Yeah.
Tim Presley and White Fence, Jill Sobule.
Ah.
And we're going to have a JGD graduate from the California Department of Corrections is going to join us. And we're going to demonstrate our program. We have a program right now every Tuesday night at the Men's Central Jail in the L.A. County Jail. And I want people to get a feel for what it is we actually do when we go into prisons and jails. We're going to do a couple of songs, unplugged, acoustic, with just the cajon and acoustic guitars that Frank Foster, great artist and songwriter, will perform together. Mm-hmm. And we also have some special guests. Artists that I'm not at liberty to reveal yet. It's going to be very
damn
exciting.
You, Wayne Kramer.
Very exciting, yeah.
Well, you know, one of the things, here's a question for you. Jason Heath, is he going to be around?
Jason Heath will be on the gig, absolutely. Yes.
Yes, I love that cat's music.
Jason is actually the coordinator of our program at MCJ right now.
Oh, cool.
He's terrific.
Well, why don't we jump into this? So for people that don't know, what is Jail Guitar Doors about? Last time we were on here, we had you and Billy Bragg on talking about it. But let's remind people, for people who maybe didn't hear it that last time, what is Jail Guitar Doors and what's it all about?
It's pretty simple. Simple idea. We find people that work in corrections that are willing to use music as a tool for rehabilitation, and we provide them with guitars. We also run some songwriting workshop programs in the Cook County Jail in Chicago, here in the LA County Jail, the San Diego County Jail, Travis County in Austin, Texas, and at Sing Sing in New York. And we're working real hard to get a program up in the Philadelphia prison system. And in these programs, we provide guitars and a space for people that have to live in these facilities to spend some time kind of escaping prison into the world of self-expression, of positive self-expression. We all work on the incentive basis, all of us, in jail or out of jail. We all have something in mind we're working for. And if we can provide people positive incentives, you know, a positive way to express themselves, say, hey, here, I'm somebody in the world. I exist. I have feelings and fears and hopes and aspirations just like anybody else. Then people will generally, not everybody, but mm-hmm. generally people that live in prisons and jails will move in that direction. There's a small percentage of knuckleheads that we're not going to reach. But generally, most people, if you make the tools to change for the better, they will. Listen, nobody likes being in prison.
Well, let me ask you this, because I read something recently which I thought, wow, this is pretty heavy. Somebody had asked you about your experience in prison, and you made a statement which I thought was very true and very important. You said, prison doesn't help anyone. Can we talk about that?
Yeah, I think American punishment as we practice it today in our country is a machine of damage and destruction. I don't know that it actually helps anybody, including society at large. The combination, this perfect storm of political expediency where politicians found votes in being perceived as tough on crime and the war on drugs has produced a hyper-incarceration industry in America that now has 2.3 million of our fellow citizens, brothers and sisters, fathers, sons, in prison under lock and key. These people that live there, they're people, they're human beings, and they're not safe. They're terrorized, they're brutalized. The system itself is designed to reduce you in your humanity. And then when we're done doing that to people for decades, we flop them back out on the street and say, oh, now participate in civic life. Mm-hmm. Be a good participant in democracy. And we really don't take responsibility for what we're doing. Is this the country that we want to be? Is this who we are, that we brutalize people? Especially half of the people in America's prisons are nonviolent economic drug crime prisoners. They have no business being in prison in the first place. Prison should be the last resort a society turns to for someone that can't get along with everybody else, not the way we do it. So we're just asking that question, you know, what kind of country are we?
And we're going to dig into that in just a second, because I want to remind people that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Wayne Kramer from the MC5, from rock and roll in general, okay? Rock, and now he's from jazz, too. You know, and actually, there's a whole other discussion that I want to get into with Wayne that we started to hit on when we talked about your last album, but that whole relationship between you and jazz and rock, which right. still blows my mind every time I think about it. Very, very heavy. And you made a statement once about if Coltrane hadn't died, if Albert Adler hadn't died, and Jimi Hendrix hadn't died, we would never have had smooth jazz and all those other monstrosities that are out there, which I really want to get into. Okay. But let's talk about this a little bit more, because
sure.
this program that you're talking about, even the songwriting classes, for instance, that you do.
Yeah.
Now, is that just music or is that lyrics as well?
It's both. We encourage the guys, and we have a program in the women's facility in Austin, Texas, too. We encourage the people to tell their story. Tell me what's going on with you. Write a song maybe to your son or to your wife or to your mom about how you got there or where you see yourself going. Because in that process, that creative process, people change. We want to change hearts and minds. Education's important. Half the people in California's prisons can't read. So education is crucial. The best guarantee to reduce recidivism is a college degree. We can educate people cheaper than we can lock them up. But really, it's about changing hearts and minds.
And I think that's really important, and I want to get back to that, because there is a point that you look at it and you think, this point about whether you believe that humans can be transformed, that hearts and minds can be changed, that if you take somebody out of the circumstances that they've grown up in, I mean, a book I'd recommend you read, especially if you're going to Philly, read Alice Goffman's book, On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City is mm-hmm. what it's called. What she does is she details the life of black people in a certain section of Philadelphia, a very poor section of Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And it's a very powerful book. And she details this whole setup that from the very beginning yeah. is designed, you know, this school to prison pipeline. It's like
cradle.
Yeah, yeah.
Cradle to prison pipeline.
And, yeah. and it's a whole section of people that have been dehumanized yeah. on the outside, yeah. dehumanized on the inside. Yeah. And there's a genocidal approach to this that is really, really, it's just terrible, and it needs to be recognized and opposed. And I think that some of what you're doing in relation to this with Jail Guitar Doors has an element of fighting against that, against the mass incarceration, against the torture in the prisons, dehumanization.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think for me, I have to find a way to militantly oppose this kind of nihilism, you know, this especially state-sponsored. And I don't know that there's a better word than genocide. I mean, when you take an entire class of people, poor people and people of color, and you look at black people don't sell more drugs than white people, they don't use more drugs than white people, but who's in prison? People of color. So clearly, something's terribly, terribly wrong here. And, you know, so part of our work as Jail Guitar Doors is to talk about this. This all starts with a conversation. And here you and I are talking about it. People are listening to us on the radio right now. Maybe they'll chat with one of their friends and say, man, I heard these guys on the radio today. What they were talking about made a little sense to me. Because it's really an out of sight, out of mind issue. Mainstream America doesn't think much about people in prison. But if you're poor or a person of color, you think about it a lot because it's part of your experience.
Yeah, you got two things that really weigh heavily on you every day when you wake up, given the fact that you do wake up, because there's the overall life system that you're forced into. But then there's also this point about, as we just saw in Ferguson, Missouri, with Michael Brown, or right here in L.A. with Zell Ford.
All the time.
Yeah, and so people are either faced with being shot down in the streets, beaten to death, whatever, or facing a lifetime in prison or in and out of prison. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's the horrible. And I wanted to ask you this. You've actually said that people have to take an unlimited ethical commitment to action, that that's what needs to be done.
Yeah.
And I think that's very important. You know, it was really very heavy for me that you said, and for you, this is based on your belief that a better world is possible.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, you know, I wondered about this for a long time. I said, geez, 3,000 years of Judeo-Christian thought, 8,000 years of Buddhist thought. but there's still genocide. There's still, you know, mass murder. There's still war. And I looked, I finally researched it, and I discovered that we are doing so much better. As a species, we're getting better at getting along in the world. We really are. And I think this is just part of that, the unsexy business of civilization building, of trying to treat each other with dignity and respect and try to move forward and move in the direction of human happiness and away from the direction of human suffering.
It's very heavy, too, though, because that point about you calling on people to take action, actually, you know, when you look at this, because we're all, whatever we take, we're doing it in the context of what's unfolding around us, which is controlled mainly by, I mean, look, wars that are going on.
The market.
The systems, the governments, all these things that actually we are living under and being squashed by and suffering under for, and some people actually are found their ways to make peace of it. But for what you were saying, I think this idea of ethical commitment to change is extremely, and unlimited ethical commitment to action, extremely important.
Our group, I'm a community musician. Joe Guitar Doors is musician founded, musician operated. This group that we have together for next Friday, I mean, Ben Harper and his mom, Tom Morello, Jackson Brown, Tim Presley, Jill Sobule, and our secret unannounced guests.
I'm going to twist your arm. You're not getting out of the studio until you tell me.
And these, I could give you a couple hints. One might go, I want to go all night. And the other one might be something like, come on, baby. But I can't mention any names.
Okay, all right.
Get involved. And this is a way to do it that's fun. And, you know, it's in our own interest to try to help people come back to the community and participate in life, rejoin their friends and family. Mm-hmm. You know, people that come out of prison are going to stand next to you in the line at the supermarket.
Or in the line to make a better world. That's
in the line to make a better world. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, yep, got it. All right, Wayne,
thanks,
I'm going to be there, so I'll see you there, but be there or be square, as we used to say many, many decades ago, okay? I don't even know where that one came from. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Wayne Kramer, guitarist and founder of Jail Guitar Doors in the U.S., and an all-around damn good person, and somebody who's actually continuing to fight for justice and has been since he was a young kid. Just smashing up that guitar in MC5 and just making me bang my head against the dashboard of an old car, okay?
Can't stop, won't stop.
Yeah, there you go, brother. All right, we're going to go out real quick now. I want to thank all of my guests today, Sansara Taylor, William Robinson, and Wayne Kramer. I also want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my board op for today, Federico Garcia. And I want to thank each and every one of you for listening to me, for tuning in each and every week. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Once again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Black 47 and Fire of Freedom. Talk to you again next week.
Abandoned by your church, I watch you suffer. Now you're older than your years, but you still look beautiful, though you're fighting back the tears. You can break down my door, you can even strip search me. Never gonna take away.